You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Laurie Rosenwald. She's a principal of Rosenworld and is a designer, an animator, an illustrator, an artist, a writer. And today we're going to talk with her about her projects and her career. Laurie, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's already fun.
I'm glad. Let's see. I'm excited to talk about your work. So tell us a little bit about Rosenworld and what it is that you're working on at the moment, your current project. We'll talk about different things, but I'd love to know what's exciting you at the moment.
Okay. Well, at the moment, I'm creating what a friend of mine calls landfill. But then again, he's a very critical Swede. In any case, it's a lot of products for a Japanese company which has my name on it in these enormous blobs of logos. And it's everything from bags to clothes to shirts to iPhone covers and different kinds of pouches and, socks and sneakers and all kinds of things. And there's going to be a pop-up store in July in Tokyo, and I'm looking forward to that. It's funny because I worked a lot in Japan in the late 80s, and then, their economy crashed and everything changed. And all of a sudden now, they sort of rediscovered me. So I'm on a second kind of Japanese adventure. So that's my main focus right now.
And those are similar designs on all kinds of things? Like, how do you approach that? I've seen, your T-shirts, the Laurie shirt, other things. How do you approach the design of all these objects? Is it similar? I mean, how does that work? What will they look
well,
like?
Well, I do sort of different things, even inside this one project. Like, I have very brightly colored, if you think about Marimekko or something like that, my version of that, a lot of them are, I guess you could say, kind of, they're very bright colors, but they're also very minimal and fun and simple. I do a lot of stripes, a lot of very basic sort of checks and dots and blobs and stripes, but they're all done in a very handmade way. So I'll do like a stripe that is made from a collage. I'll cut paper very roughly, and that's the stripe, rather than do something perfectly or on the computer. So what I like and what the whole collection has in common is things that are normal, regular, like a stripe or a check or a polka dot, but done in a very handmade, you might say childish way or simple way, so that it has some soul. That's what I like to do. I like to do things that are normal, but where you have an element that is crispy and crunchy and graphic and done on the computer maybe, or very regular and normal, and then an aspect that is very organic and handmade and out of control at the same time.
So that's an approach that, and especially having a pop-up store that typically happens to well-known designers, right? Like, that could be a Hello Kitty store, there could be a store by any one of a variety of popular designers who often do something like this. They happen, some big name designers. I've seen that throughout Europe and somewhat in the United States. Is that how you're viewed and seen? You seem to have such a kind of broad creative reach that I don't see you as like an iconic designer that way. But is that how they're seeing you?
I can't believe it. Are you telling me you don't know that I'm world famous?
Well, I guess I do because I wanted to
interview
you.
You weren't aware that I'm a giant of the industry? No, I'm absolutely unknown. But for some reason, these people in Japan think that I should be known, and they've shown these to all these manufacturers and places that think that it's fantastic. And I think there is something about my work that maybe particularly in Japan and also in Europe, or at least certain parts of Europe, flies better than it does sometimes in America. That it's, a lot of things in America are much more representational, and my work is in a lot of ways abstract or very simple. And And I think that a lot of American clients might see it as childish or too simple. And in, you know, Sweden, where I live part of the time, or in France or in Japan, to them it looks, you know, clean, but it doesn't look too empty. So I don't know. Maybe that's something to do with it. But no, I don't know why they think a pop-up store will work, and maybe it won't. I have no idea.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Marimekko, I guess, does come to mind, as you were saying.
But they have, you know, they're much more precious, and these items are going to be very inexpensive. So what I'm trying to do is, even though these are, you know, it might be a bag that sells for $5 or $10 or something, that it will look great and be, you know, a really good design.
Right. Okay, so that's kind of fascinating, because this is also, I mean, yet another sort of leg of your career where some whole new, not a new persona, but this could potentially be a huge launch and make you the household name that you are. So let's go back to the beginning of your career then, because I'd like to know how all that started. You could start back when you were a child or when you graduated college. Where did you get that?
Well, it started in a log cabin on East 69th Street. No, I started in Manhattan, and I'm still here. But
How did you get involved in the arts or your
practice? Well, it's just something that I've always done. I was talking to some friends the other day, and it just sort of, I said, you know, we're the ones that kept drawing. You know, all the kids that are 3 years old are drawing, and then some of them stop. And then the ones that keep going are the ones that end up, you know, maybe in art school or becoming some kind of a visual, you know, job in when they grow up. And I've just never not drawn pictures and made stuff. And also, I've also always been writing and things, but as long as I can remember. You know, I never was interested in, you know, sports or regular stuff. I always just like reading and writing and drawing. That's my thing. So this is just an extension of that.
And so when you graduated college, let's say, was that the beginning? I'm interested to know how you brought that out into the world, or how you began to find a commercial application for that kind of childlike notion, which, as you say, many of us have done, but we all stop at some point. How did you bring that to market?
Tell you the truth, I'm still looking for a commercial application. I mean, it's a miracle that I ever make any money, and I don't make a lot of money, but it's, you know, I really approach everything in totally the wrong way. I think like an artist and act like an artist and, you know, get completely obsessed and carried away and spend hundreds of hours on things that, you know, I should spend 20 minutes on, because I want to, because it's fun. And, you know, every time I get a commercial assignment, I think, oh boy, Lori Rosenwald gets to do whatever she wants and express herself. And of course, that's not the way the clients are thinking, you know. It's completely wrong. And on the other hand, if my work is any good, maybe that's why, because I have so much fun, you know, and I think that comes through in the final product, and people see that. So when they look at my work, they feel that I had a good time doing this, you know, that it wasn't just to make money or a chore or anything but joy. So,
right.
You know, that's always been my approach, and it's the same for me. I have the same feeling about my work, whether I'm making a painting or writing a story or doing an animation or doing a Bloomingdale's bag. To me, they're all, you know, on the very top layer. There's not one that has, you know, more validity or importance than the other. I mean, I'm sure to the outside world, there's a painting, you know, might have more status than an illustration. An illustration in a magazine is just fish wrap, you know, and people look at it for a nanosecond. But I don't care. In the actual act of drawing and making stuff, it's all good. And in the space of a day, I'll do all those different things. It's completely normal for me. Like whenever I give a talk, And sometimes students at art schools ask me questions. I say, you know, I'm 60 now almost, and I still haven't picked a major, you know, and I haven't.
Hmm. Well, when was the first time that, you know, you began experimenting with all your talents? I mean, was there a pivotal point after college or something where suddenly you thought, wow, people like this? And not that it was a product or a career, but something that you realized had a potential, either commercial or career value for you. Was there an acknowledgement or a break or a sale or a reception somewhere that made you realize that?
Well, to be honest with you, it's sort of, that's sort of the opposite of my experience. What happened was that I've always had, whether I deserve it or not or whatever, in myself. And where was I reading this? Or there was somebody else that was saying, it sounded awful and pretentious, but I can't remember who it was. It reminded me of me, which they were saying, like, how could you not know what you like and whether something is good? How could you not know? Like, when I draw or make stuff or write or whatever it is, I know if it's good, and that's the only thing I care about. And if I ask other people, what do you think, it's only to be polite. I mean, there's, of course, a difference between, you want to please the client, you want them to be happy and that you're communicating on their behalf and that it fulfills the brief and does the job that it's supposed to do that they've asked you to do. That's one thing. But in terms of, is this a good drawing and is it beautiful or does it work in and of itself, I've always known yes or no, sometimes no, but I know it. And I don't really base how I feel about the work on what other people think. I never have, you know. And the fact that sometimes people would pay me to draw, it was a marvel to me. And it was just sort of gravy. It was just great, you know. But sometimes they pay me and sometimes they don't. I mean, that's the truth of it. Still, you know, some things, like if you do a big advertising job, it could be a lot of money. But they don't come off, you know, they don't come around that often. It's
right.
Once in a blue moon I do a big advertising job. But sometimes, and that's really fun. But, and I love to make money. But, you know, for years I did a lot of editorial illustration, and that pays very little. And doing books is the best thing in the world, but it also pays very little unless you happen to have a bestseller or something, you know. So
right.
I basically just keep going and make things and create stuff every day, no matter what. And I don't know if that
So let's talk a little. Let's talk a little bit about the workshop. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
And that's why you're an artist. Mistakes on Purpose workshop. This has been,
right.
You know, it seems to be a huge workshop that had a tremendous reception. I know you've done them for IKEA, Starbucks, and you know, all kinds of arts and technology groups and Google. You've done these workshops for.
Yeah.
That seems powerful and a way that you're not only expressing what you're doing, but you're really sharing and igniting other people. Can you talk a little bit about how that workshop
started?
Yeah.
It's only about doing things. And it's I don't give a talk. I mean, I do give talks, but the workshop is completely participatory. It's something that people have to, you know, actively participate. And I don't really tell everybody in any form, not on the radio, or podcast or written or anything, what we actually do in that room. And I always ask the people that participate to swear omerta, you know, that's the mafia code of silence. So that's kind of fun. You know, it's a secret what we do. But the reason it's a secret is because it's about surprise. And the way I look at things, particularly in the last, you know, 25, 30 years when people use computers, that every time you click the mouse, you're making a decision, and computers don't make mistakes. I mean, the only thing they can do is crash. Otherwise, everything they do is completely logical. And that's why a lot of things, I think, look alike, because those programs are very powerful. So I think people, they want to I don't want to say get away from that because I'm not anti-computer at all. I use a computer all the time, every day. But I think what happens is when people get used to being good at something and they're using the computer and getting certain results, whatever job they're in, because the people that take the workshop, they could be in banking or they could be in marketing or sales or anything, it doesn't matter. They don't have to be artists or designers. Anybody can do it. And so I've had all kinds of people that really appreciate it because what we do is we go into this room and people have absolutely no idea what to expect or what it's going to be like. And what happens in there is we create chaos. And afterwards we say, oh, what could this be? And the only example I ever give to sort of explain it is about the guy, Georges de Mestral, who invented Velcro. Okay, he went walking in the woods and got burrs stuck on his pants, right? So he went home and he was like playing with the burrs. And, oh, what could this be? And then he invented Velcro because they stuck together, right? But he never sat down at a clean white desk and thought, what this world needs is a new way to stick stuff together. And I'm going to be creative now and I'm going to do that. Because that's problem solving. And that's what you do in design school and in everything else every day. So what I do is the opposite of that. Rather than problem solving, which is perfectly valid when you're trying to get from A to B and you know where you're going, that's fine. But for one day a year or 3 days or whatever the workshop might be, you're not problem solving. You're just letting things happen and then saying, oh, what did I do? What could that be? What could this be? And it's like working backwards. So people have a lot of fun because it is chaotic, and I do play loud music, which I do tell people about. And it's super fun, and there's no critique of any kind or any of that stuff. It's not like regular art school experience or anything. So people have new ideas and invent new things because there's really no, you know, going from A to B, there's no trying. Sometimes not trying works better than trying. That's what it's all about. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. Of course it makes sense. You know, I mean, it's actively not trying somehow.
Exactly.
That seems to have been enormously popular. This is something that, I mean, you do it an awful lot of things, but I would imagine that was something that was, that it strikes me as I look through your work and bio and everything, that was something that is enormously popular, that people seem to love.
Oh, it is. It's super, super fun. And it's great because sometimes I do it for art schools. I've done it for, you know, Pratt and Parsons and SVA and CalArts and MICA and RISD and Camberwell in London and, you know, lots and lots of really good art schools. But then I also do it for corporations, like you said, Starbucks and Google and all those, you know, other places, where I also did it for, you know, Eric Spiekerman, who's this incredible typographer, and they have teams all over the world, but I did it in Berlin, and these people have such incredible design chops and so great they have metal and wood typography shop. It is fantastic. It was just a great place to do this. But, you know, and I've done it for Art Directors Club and AIGA and a lot of design people, but I really like it almost better to do it for people that are not necessarily designers, and they seem to get the most out of it and have even more fun. And I think that if they, you know, my greatest fear, and the reason I don't describe it more, is that I'm terrified that people think that it's about, you know, being good at art or design or anything. It's not about that at all. It's about, like I said, like not trying, like coming up with new ideas in whatever job you have, that there's a good way to do it that doesn't involve problem solving and involves surprise and, you know, like a little epiphany. And it's very hard to do that. You know, everybody knows that Post-it notes and Sacklin and Viagra and all these things, there's a whole long list that everybody knows how they were, you know, invented by quote-unquote mistake. But what it is things like that, connections in your mind that could be something happen all the time. I mean, it's not an unusual thing. People have experiences and thoughts in everyday life a zillion times a day that make incredible connections, but they don't do anything with them, you know? So
right.
It's a way to do things with them and bring them out.
I mean, that's a very kind of powerful thing, I think, to bring to the world. It would seem that everyone needs more of that.
Yes, everyone on Earth should take the workshop. I would be very busy.
So how do you do these workshops often? Like, I mean, I'm fascinated with it. I'd like to take the workshop. Maybe listeners would like to take the workshop. Is it offered this year in different places in the United States or abroad?
Well, actually, I don't have anything scheduled now, which is sort of unusual. There are certain places I do it, like in Iceland, in Reykjavik, at their art school. I do it every August. But other than that, I only do it a few times a year. And it's just whoever asks me that, you know, where it makes sense, where and when I can, you know, figure it out. I mean, I would love to do it at Yale. I would love to do it at a place like that. But I don't, to tell you the truth, I'm not really connected at Yale or know people there. But that would be super fun, you know, and not necessarily in the design department either. It could be any department. Could be anybody. I would love it if it were open to anybody.
Right. I mean, I would think it could happen in you know, all kinds of institutions. And there's no way, this isn't in a book form, right? You're not writing a book about this. This is
I am,
something
as a matter
must
of fact.
Be.
I am. I'm doing a book right now. Hopefully Abrams will publish it. I'm sort of working with them on it, on and off, called How to Make Mistakes on Purpose. And there's a section in my website about it, too. Which is Rosenworld, Rosenworld. It's not my last name. So anyway, in there, there's some info, but it doesn't really say exactly what we do, but it has, like, testimonials from people that really enjoyed doing it, being there.
Right, I saw those. Now, would the book help people with actually how to do it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, who knows? I hope so. But I haven't finished the book yet myself, so what do I know? I hope so.
So you'll see. Well, it's exciting talking about these things. To me, that seems, you know, such a touchstone for artists and not just creative people, but business people everywhere, because it's always a challenge. How do you have that epiphany? Artists are always looking for that next magic moment when they have a breakthrough or something, but end up, you know, often doing the opposite. I was talking to an artist the other day who said, you know, for so long he was just doing, you know, what was safe. He had an epiphany, something did work, and then he just kept repeating it for a long time.
Yeah, the results when you're smart and sophisticated, and especially when you're using computers, but you know, and then you get to a certain age and a certain level where you're really, really got incredible chops at something, and you keep repeating the same things because you know you'll get good results. But then you don't get to surprise yourself and move on to something else and something new, which is what it's all about, you know. And I'll tell you something about interviewing people, because I know you do this a lot. I did this for, believe it or not, Kurt Anderson, you know, has that Studio 360 show. And
right.
He invited me because he was the, whatchamacallit, MC at this AIGA function, and he, you know, saw the workshop and everything and thought it was fun. So he invited me to do this on the radio, which when you think about it is completely cuckoo banana nuts, you know, because it's a visual sort of thing, but it's the radio. So I said, sure. So I went to his, you know, to do this with his group, with his staff at the radio at Studio 360, and it was about 15 people that worked there, and they recorded the whole thing, and they ended up not broadcasting it for a variety of reasons, but it was still good, and it was really fun. And before the thing happened, his producer called me on the phone to ask me a bunch of questions and sort of interview me about what it was going to be like, right? It wasn't, I mean, they weren't interviewing me on air or anything. It was just asking me. So he said, well, what do you get out of this if you're not an artist, you know, if you're not a designer or something? And I said, well, let's say you're an interviewer. Let's say you're a radio interviewer. And he goes, oh, I'm listening, you know. So, yeah. I says, well, you could ask me, Lori, where'd you go to school, or how long have you been doing this, or how'd you get the idea for it? But let's say for one of the questions, you just sort of reach across your desk and you find something and you let that be the question. That's what the workshop is all about. So I said, I'll do that now. So I was talking to him, but I had a novel on my desk, and I opened it up, and the first letter, the first two words on the top left page were gold bullion, okay? So I said, oh, Lori, you know, do you make big bucks with this? Do you do this for big corporations and, you know, really bring in a lot of bacon, you know, or is this some underground thing you do just at art schools and you're an impoverished artist? You know, it might not have been a great question, but it was probably a question he wouldn't have asked me. And that was the point, right? So, you know, it's not really mistakes. I like the way How to Make Mistakes on Purpose sounds, but it's not really what I mean. What I really mean is what I love are, I love the surprise of things, and I love the random, you know, that is, for me, really important to get away from yourself and repeating the same kind of experiences. You have to let the random in. You know what I mean?
Right. So can we try that now at the end
sure.
of this call? Is there, how would we
yeah,
do
you
that?
You don't have to warn me. You can. Sure you can.
So how would that work? I'm in a room in an office. Okay. I'm going to open the book. It's called The 13-Petaled Rose. And looking at the word in the top left-hand page, it's light, the declining light and the actual darkness.
Ooh, the declining light and the actual darkness. Now, what kind of question could that suggest to you?
So here's a question I wouldn't have thought of asking. Lori, the idea of our world being a projection of something that we are inside but doesn't contain hard facts in itself, but more not so much what our eyes are seeing, but what our mind or our heart is believing out there. Do you feel that you have a particular way of seeing the world that isn't so much about fact, but about how you're perceiving it and relating with it to other people as well as all your projects?
Yes. No, okay. I can expand on that. Sometimes the British say, cheer up, it might never happen. Have you ever heard that expression? But
yeah.
Anyway, it's sort of that. Like, I think that it takes a lot of guts or something to be cheerful in this world, and I don't do it on purpose. I think it sort of comes to me naturally because I had a really crappy childhood and a crazy mother, blah, blah, blah. But I think that, I was joking. Okay, here's the, this is convoluted, but night before last I was at a dinner party with a bunch of people, and we were talking about the movie Citizen 4 about Edward Snowden. And I'm very happy it won a prize at the Academy Awards because my friend Kirsten was the cinematographer and one of the producers. And they were talking about, you know, the idea of America's surveillance on its own citizens and things like that, all these things that came to light that were so awful. But it's like, in a way, I said, I'm deeply cynical. Like, of course, if they have the technology, they're going to do the spying. And then somebody else was saying, oh, you know, but you have to be able to do that stuff to catch terrorists on the one hand. And then somebody else was saying, yeah, but I don't like that Amazon knows exactly where I am every minute of the day and what I'm buying and what I like. And the big corporations, that bothers me more than what the NSA is doing and blah, blah. And I was saying, well, none of it bothers me. Because, you know, what have I got? I'm almost 60. I've got like 20 more years, maybe if I'm lucky. And, you know, in that time, I really deeply do not care. And, you know, it's going to like just upset me to think about the horrible fact that corporations and the government are spying on me and things like that. I never think about that kind of stuff. I just don't. And I always think about the expression, après moi le déluge, you know, they say in French, after me the flood, because first of all, I don't have children, and maybe if I did, I'd feel differently. But I figure, you know, we're all going extinct. Probably even if we recycled everything perfectly and did everything we could do to help the environment and be green and be better, that, I mean, I'm not saying I don't recycle and things I do, or I try to be good. And maybe because I don't have children, I'm golden, you know, as far as my carbon footprint or whatever. But the fact is that, you know, I don't think we're long for this earth, and maybe in a few generations we'll be kaput. So and I just want to have a wonderful time and, you know, make some beautiful stuff and have fun and see my friends and joke around, and then I'll die, you know. Like, and one of my friends that was there, and it would ruin my life if in these 20 years I was freaked out about the inevitability of all this horrible stuff that's happening, you know. I think it's too late. It's too bloody late, and then I just accept it. So that's my philosophy, if you like it, and it really affects everything. It's this deep cynicism that makes me cheerful because I figure it's too late.
I love that. Thank you. That's a great example. Of course, much heavier than I ever would get into in an interview.
Right. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you, and especially in the end here, because there, you know, that is, in a way, I think very, very profound. It's not cynical. It's sort of like the end of so many great movies, stories, you know, like 8½ or something, the Fellini film. It's what is life about, but, you know, kind of loving each other and laughing with friends and having dinner. That's ultimately what we have.
Oh, no question about it in my mind. Yeah, yeah. I'm having a great time.
Lori, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for the opportunity of doing just that.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.